Thank you. That's lovely. I appreciate that. I'm so sorry everything is so long and complicated and has too many syllables. Much easier. Just a nun. I'm also a singer in the Santa Barbara Choral Society, so that's my other local fanatic interest. So, it's a really interesting topic on compassion, and I very much enjoyed reading Karen Armstrong's book. And I was struck because how often we, during our regular life, we hear the word compassion. And I think the word compassion can often be misused. I actually hear it quite a bit up in our bookstore when there's a breakup of in a relationship and the wrong party has moved on from feelings of total fury to smug disdain. In other words, I'm still hurt and angry, and the only way I can show my moral superiority over you is to show how spiritual and compassionate I am compared to the low life you are. In other words, I've earned my bitterness, and by damn, I'm going to keep it. Now, this, I hope, is not what we're talking about when we talk about compassion. Because compassion is not being more spiritual than thou, and it's not about feeling sorry for anybody. Now, compassion today is often associated with Buddhism. But the truth is, as we know, it crosses all religious boundaries. It's prized in Buddhism, in Hinduism, in Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. And that's because compassion is central to who we are as human beings. And we probably associate compassion with Buddhism now because of the shining example of the Dalai Lama, who exemplified in his own life real compassion for those who literally tried to kill him, literally, and did kill and torture his people. He's a wonderful example. He freaks frequently and eloquently about compassion. He famously said, if you want others to be happy, practice compassion. If you want to be happy, practice compassion. That's about as good of a summary of the matters we're ever going to get. He also said we can reject everything else. Religion, ideology, all received wisdom. But we cannot escape the necessity of love and compassion. This, I think, is really inarguable. But before we can get to that place, we need to analyze what compassion is in the first place. As we all know, compassion comes from the Greek pathein, to undergo, suffer, experience. And our word pathos comes from the same root. Come, the Latin, you can tell I'm an old classicist. The word come, Latin, is with. So it's to endure with, suffer with someone else, or the Native Americans would say, to walk in someone else's moccasins, to make someone else's pain as intimate and as real as our own. Compassion, then, is not pity, even though that wretched OED, the Oxford English Dictionary, defines compassion as piteous or pitiable, which is probably where we get this contemporary misunderstanding about the meaning. It's not sentimental. It's not reveling in someone's pain or sorrow, and it's not about getting the rush of secondhand drama, right? Which isn't compassion at all, but sort of an emotional voyeurism. Like, my life is boring, you know, but I can kind of get into your drama. It's not that. It's really experiencing and identifying the pain of others as our own, just as we would experience it. Now, this idea strongly resonates in the Hindu tradition, where in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says to Arjuna that the highest yogi, it's not the one who gets in the lotus position, the highest yogi is the one who looks upon the pleasure and pain of all beings as his or her own. That is the highest yogi. Karen Armstrong's book, 12 Steps to a Compassionate Life, she defines compassion as an attitude of principled, consistent altruism. I got a problem with that. Okay, you're going to hear about it for the next 45 minutes. Okay. But if we go along with this definition, we run into a problem. How can we define compassion by another term, altruism? Because it's circular reasoning, isn't it? Define one by another. Well, what does altruism mean? Well, here we go again with the Latin. The Latin root of altruism is the Latin noun alter. like an alter ego, other. It means, or like the French, autrui, the other. The other. Now, perhaps some of you have heard the term otherizing. It's in fairly common use now, to otherize other people. It means to see another group or a social, either a person or a social group, as somehow inherently alien or different than me and those like me. That's what it is. When otherizing goes to an extreme, we end up with various holocausts. The Nazis and the Jews were inherently other. The Hutus and the Tutsis, the Serbs and the Bosnians, the Protestants and the Catholics in Northern Ireland. We have it today with Pakistan and India, with the Muslims and the Hindus. It's been historically at play with white people and African Americans, white people and Native Americans, and all these miseries go on and on, and unfortunately, it's just the list is pretty endless. All this comes by seeing others as the other. And if not, they're not worthy of death, they're at least incomprehensible. We simply can't identify them. Now, most of us, of course, don't go to such extremes. We don't put people to death just because they are Jewish or they're Jehovah's Witnesses or black. But we run into it all day long. We don't really notice it because we all have our versions of what constitutes the other. Maybe they're Republicans. To my mother, they're Republicans. Or maybe they're Democrats. Maybe they're gays. Maybe they're racists. Maybe they're bigots. Isn't it okay to despise bigots and racists? Isn't it okay to despise terrorists? What about wife beaters? Child molesters? Dog abusers? We all draw our own lines. And we can all fill in our own blanks here. Those people who are inherently alien and different than me and people like me, we put them out there. That's what the alter is. So as you can see, I got a basic definition with that. According to the 19th century French philosopher Auguste Comte, who coined the term altruism, he defined it as social altruism is social sympathy. Great. Another circular definition. What's sympathy? Sympathy, to feel with. But we get to another problem because there's always the other. There's me, and then there's you. There's me and people like me, and there's you and people like you. We're back to square one. There's always me and everything else. Altruism is say, you know, we want to be good, do good, and but all these other people out there. But this, according to the Hindu tradition, doesn't cut it. It doesn't work because the inherent dualism inherent in this, and this duality will always, 100% of the time, give us grief. The Hindu tradition has a whole problem with this whole dualistic notion. What do I mean by dualism or duality? When we're talking about two rather than one. That I am separated from everything and everyone else. That you are a person and I'm a person and God is a being out there and he or she is separate and radically distinct from you and me and creation. Now this is the Western worldview. And this is the tradition of all the Abrahamic traditions. The Hindu tradition, on the other hand, insists that oneness or unity is the law of life and it is the song of life. That in and through all this wonderful diversity that we see manifest before us, inherent in that is a wonderful unity that is more real and more permanent than all the diversity we see and experience around us. And the Hindu tradition further asserts that we are all united in and through this divinity. Every single one of us. Everything, everyone. Through divinity. Now the bottom line of Hindu philosophy says that the deepest core of my being and every being's being is divine. It's eternal. It's changeless, birthless, deathless. The Bhagavad Gita, one of Hinduism's most sacred scriptures, says that bodies are said to die, but that which possesses the body is eternal. The self, the divine within us, is pure, perfect, unaffected by all the changes that go around us and inside of us. It's unaffected by that. The divine core of our being, they call in Sanskrit Atman, and it is absolutely one with that infinite divine reality that is the basis of this universe. That is called Brahman in Sanskrit. And this Brahman pervades this universe as absolute divinity. Now, this being within us and without us is eternal, divine, all-pervading. Now, there can't be two eternal, all-pervading divine realities. That's logically impossible. There can be only one. There is and can be only one divine existence. That means all these limitations we ascribe to ourselves and to everybody else are false. Our bodies and our minds come and go. Our minds weaken. They're strong, then they get weak. They also come and go. But we are not our bodies or our minds. We are that infinite divine reality. The core of our being is absolutely one with God. Absolutely. We are that infinite divine reality. That same reality which pervades this universe is that same reality at the core of every being. It illumines my consciousness and illumines everyone's consciousness, our intelligence, and is the source of all our joy. Every bit of joy that we get is because we have the infinite fount of joy in our own hearts. That's where it comes from. It's just reified from the outside. The same divinity in our hearts is the same divinity that illumines the sun and the moon and the stars. There is no place where we who are infinite in nature, are not. We are there. Therefore, the Hindu tradition would kind of like to nuance the Golden Rule. The Golden Rule was coined by Confucius 500 years before the Common Era. He said, never do unto others what you would not like them do unto you. And all religions subscribe to this belief. And that's, of course, absolutely true. And if everyone in the world did that, we would have no world problems. It seems so simple. Of course, we would still have those intractable existential problems of suffering, birth, old age, and death. We can't avoid it. It's the tax that we pay for having this body. It's the tax we pay for using this matter for a time. With that, we pay the tax of suffering, old age, disease, and death. That's our tax. But the Hindu tradition says that suffering, old age, disease, and death can affect only the body-mind complex. Only this outer shell. But that is not who we are. It cannot affect us. The Hindu tradition says, don't limit yourself. You are the infinite. You are limitless, eternal spirit. Old age and disease and death can never touch us. It can never touch us. We are one with the universe. Now, with this in mind, the Hindu tradition restates the Golden Rule as never do unto others what you would not like them do unto you, because there are no others. Your neighbor is yourself. Your neighbor is you. We're just looking at different manifestations. Now, let me go on with this idea for a bit, because now we can maybe, you know, wrap our minds around this idea of oneness intellectually. But it's pretty hard to put into practice. Now, we've got no problem feeling an identification with Mother Teresa or Gandhi or Dalai Lama or Swami Vivekananda. We can readily identify with those we already love and admire. And it's not too much of a stretch to try to feel our oneness with the forest, with the trees, with the sky, with the ocean. When we do that, we feel this profound sense of peace. And we do because we're kind of expanding our identity. We're kind of getting out of this trap of the ego, which is so painful to carry around all the time. And we feel kind of joy in feeling that oneness, well, that's because this oneness is really inherent to who we are. It's natural to us. But most of us kind of balk at feeling oneness with a cockroach, right?
Yeah.
Or a rat. Especially the tree rats where we are. Or even more problematic, the guy who ripped us off. The person who betrayed us. The person who hurt my kid. Or my dog. Or me. The person who's the child molester. And that's when the going gets rough. I have no problem trying to feel oneness with, comes pretty naturally actually, St. Francis. You know, sorry to Davy. But please don't ask me to identify with people who hurt others for no good reason. That's where we kind of draw our own lines. And that's where 99% of us are. We can identify with the good, but we can't identify with the bad. And that brings me back to Karen Armstrong's book on compassion. She says that, quote, "There is no doubt that in the deepest recess of their minds, men and women are indeed ruthlessly selfish," end quote. Well, I object to that. I strongly object to that. In fact, I put the book down. I said, how can you say that, Karen? And the Hindu tradition objects to it as well. First of all, she says, in the deepest recesses of our minds. Well, guess what? We're not our minds. Our minds are matter. The mind is a covering over our deepest self, the divine within, and that is who we are. By nature, we are unselfish. By nature. Since oneness is the law of life, whatever we do to affirm that oneness makes us feel fine. It feels good. When we feel unselfish, when we act in an unselfish way, when we feel love and compassion, that feels right. And when we act, it's just as natural to us as breathing. Now, on the other hand, when we are selfish and uncompassionate, it feels really crappy. We don't feel good. And I don't know one person who does. We feel good when we act in a compassionate way because we're going with our own grain. It is natural to who we are and what we are as noble, divine beings. Acting without compassion goes against our own grain. And we feel pretty miserable about it. A lack of compassion is actually it's a symptom. It's like the spiritual flu. It's like it shows that something systemic is out of sync. It's like when your window gets off the track and something's wrong here. That's what a lack of compassion is like on a spiritual level. Selfishness and lack of compassion is a symptom of wrong identification. It shows that we're thinking in a way that we're limiting ourselves to this small body-mind complex. And that doesn't feel right. Now, Karen Armstrong says that, here I go again, according to the latest scientific thought, humanity is believed to have evolved from the reptilian brain, which concerns itself only with the four Fs. Feeding, fighting, fleeing, and making whoopee, right? And that's about it, right?
Let's get down to it.
But now that we're noble and evolved human beings, okay, we've got this great new brain with its new neocortex, which is the home of reasoning, right? And it allows us to stand back from our primitive instincts and passions. And we can stand on reason. With reason, we realize that if we don't develop compassion, we'll end up in complete self and world annihilation. It's reason got us here. I'm sorry. This argument does not work with Hinduism, because no matter whether we're talking about our dumb 4F reptilian brain or we're talking about our cool new and hip neocortex brain, which kind of reminds me of the latest version of the iPod, right? Or the iPhone, you know, it's like, I got a new brain, neocortex. We're not the brain in the freaking first place. We are not the brain. We are not the brain as matter. We are not the brain, we are not the body, not the various evolved or non-evolved versions thereof. We are divine, pure, and perfect, and ever free. Now, Karen Armstrong, who I deeply admire, I love her books. Says, quote, compassion is in our best interest. Oh, dear. I don't even know where to begin with that statement. Are you kidding me? Compassion is as natural to us as breathing. Just as unselfishness is. Just as love is. I mean, do you love because it's your best interest? You love because that's who you are. That's who we are. It's to do otherwise goes against the truest part of our being. Now, in speaking of the Hindu tradition, Armstrong accurately writes that once a person encounters the immense and unborn Atma, this divine within us, which is unaging, undying, and free from fear, once they experience this, they, she said, are free of terror and anxiety. Now, she comments that the person then, quote, is no longer so completely enthralled to the instinctive, acquisitive drive that compelled him or her to want more and more, to pursue, desire, achieve, and consume. Well, this is true, but it's not true because this person has overcome the reptilian brain with a cool new human neocortex, but because that person who has realized the divine within herself has realized beyond a shadow of a doubt that he or she is that divine reality, that nothing and no one can ever take this realization away from them. The person realizes that she is birthless and deathless, unchanging and free, and she is fearless because she knows that nothing and no one can take this knowledge away from her. That, and she realizes that every person reflects that same divinity, that every person, when she sees another being, she sees that first before she sees the body and the mind and any failing they may have. That's what she's responding to. When we know, when we absolutely know as clearly as we can see the hands in front of our face that we are the infinite, that we are not bound by birth or death, that we are free and perfect and absolutely whole, that we're untainted by the failings of our body or whatever weakness we may have in our mind, when we know that, when it becomes so much part of who we are, that's our experience of day in daily life, then what fear or what hatred or what pettiness could ever overcome us? That's where this understanding comes from. It's not from reason. It's from realization. It is realization. Realization of our own inherent divinity. Now, reason will point us in the right direction, but it doesn't take us there because reason far exceeds the limits of our rational mind, which is really a pretty small gig to deal with. Realization comes from the exalted realm of the spirit. No matter if we have a neocortex or not, if we think that myself, who I am, is limited to this body-mind complex, then we will become subject to fear and want. If we think we're limited to this. When I think I'm limited and I'm weak, I will do everything I can do to push this false me ahead of everybody else. And I will do anything I can to be bigger than the small person I fear myself to be. One of the world's oldest scriptures, the Isha Upanishad, says, the Atman, the divine self within, the Atman is present everywhere. Whoever sees all beings in the Atman and the Atman in all beings hates none. For the person who sees oneness everywhere, how can there be delusion or grief? It's a wonderful statement. This is where our fearlessness comes from. Not from our mighty neocortex, but from the knowledge of the divine self within. All our fear and our misery comes from our sense of separation from this great, great divine unity, this web of divinity that enfolds us and encloses us and supports us and nourishes us all through our life. Another ancient Upanishad, the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, love to see you say that one, says such a simple statement, there is fear from the second. Wonderful, simple, profound statement. There is fear from the second. As long as we see a second, we will always experience fear. Duality, our sense of separation from the rest of creation, is always a misperception because it implies that there's something other than God. Something that's not enclosed in that. There can be no other. Swami Vivekananda, the great monk who brought Hinduism to this country over a century ago, said, the person who says that he or she is different from others, even by a hair's breadth, immediately becomes miserable. Happiness belongs to the person who knows this oneness, who knows that she or he is one with the universe. That is when we have joy. With any sense of duality, there is always fear. If there is love, there is a fear of the loss of love. Whether they leave us, or they die, or they just get bored. If there's duality, there's the fear the person will hurt us, will leave us, embarrass us, take what we have, or get what we want. All right? That's the basic issue with either altruism or compassion, because it's done with the idea of doing good to others. That's the problem. It puts us up here, and those we feel like kindly disposed towards, those we have compassion for, those are down there. There's an inherent lack of equality there, because there is a mark between two beings. We're doing them a favor by being compassionate. There's such deep egocentricity in that idea. The great 19th century Saint Ramakrishna was once discussing the ideas of a particular Hindu sect. And Ramakrishna was being told by this person who walked in the room that those who belonged to that sect believed that first they were supposed to relish and love the name of God. They were to serve others belonging to their sect. And they were to have compassion to all creatures. Compassion for all creatures, knowing that all creatures belong to God. Now when Sri Ramakrishna heard that, he said, compassion for creatures? You fool! An insignificant worm crawling on the earth, you to show compassion to others? Who are you to show compassion? No, it cannot be. Not compassion for others, but rather service to humanity, recognizing them as veritable manifestations of God. Now, this is the place where we need to end up. Not that we're doing anyone any big favors by us feeling compassion for them, but that we feel genuine gratitude for the opportunity to worship God in his disguise as a human being, in his disguise as our spouse or child or boss or neighbor, as the homeless man, God in disguise as the mentally ill woman, as the person who treats us with disdain or contempt, the lady at Trader Joe's who's putting up our groceries for us. All these various masks that the divine reality is wearing, these little masquerades. This isn't to say that we come like Pollyanna and say, guys, everyone and everything is rosy and isn't just great, we're all divine, yeah. Bring me the next axe murder, we'll have ice cream together, yeah. Great, yoo-hoo. Sri Ramakrishna said, be religious, but don't be a fool. Right? Ramakrishna said, God dwells in the tiger, but don't go and embrace the tiger. You salute the tiger from a distance. You over here, me over here, I salute you. I respect and salute and acknowledge the divinity within you. He used to, again, salute from a distance. And this is how we are to address and deal with the people who willingly hurt others, including ourselves. While we are one, it's true, we are united in and through that same divinity. That doesn't mean that we're exactly the same. And it doesn't mean we're all in the same state of spiritual evolution. We're not. We're not. It's true that every being has divinity at their core, but some have clouds of ignorance that make that divinity very, very hard to see. In great beings like Jesus, Buddha, Muhammad, Ramakrishna, all these great saints, and many, many others that are completely unknown and unsung, there are no clouds at all covering their divinity, and the great light of the divine shines right through them. In others, there's such a thick accumulation of ignorance that's very, very difficult to see. But that divinity is there, and we have to acknowledge it. We have to acknowledge that divinity and respond to that divinity in them rather than their ignorance. We should see their divinity first while acknowledging that the clouds are there. We salute them knowing that while they give others great pain, that they are also suffering great pain as well. In fact, more than their victims. To be trapped in a mind that wants to hurt and hate is a terrible place to be. That is real suffering. That is great suffering. But let's keep in mind that compassion does not mean being a doormat or a willing victim or an enabler. That is not compassion. It's very important to remember there's a world of difference between being a doormat, an enabler, or a willing victim, and a person who aspires to love and serve others as manifestations of divinity. Just as there's a great difference between genuine humility and one who has a complete lack of self-respect, there's also a difference between being compassionate and being a doormat. A person who willingly allows themselves to be treated badly has a distorted sense of self, of who they are. Just as one who is egotistic and pretentious has a distorted sense of self. It's the same problem. They're taking the false, limited, tiny, pathetic self and taking that for the true self, the real self, the divine within us. Our real self, the Atman, doesn't need propping up with petty manifestations of power and control. That's not who anybody is. So we always need to be on guard against thinking of ourselves as weak or limited or worthless or helpless. We always have to be on guard of that. Because when we do, we are doing a terrible injustice for ourselves, and then the damage goes deeper. We cannot go there. Further, if we think of ourselves as weak, limited, and worthless, we will treat others the same way given the opportunity. We always have to be on guard. And this leads us to the next point, having compassion for ourselves. Karen Armstrong tells the story of the late Rabbi Albert Friedlander, who, as she said, was one of the kindest and gentlest people she ever knew. He'd grown up in Nazi Germany and grew up with vicious anti-Semitic propaganda. And it's very easy to internalize negative stereotypes, as all colonized people and all minorities unfortunately know all too well. Now, we all know the famous biblical statement, love thy neighbor as thyself. And as Armstrong points out, most people concentrate on the first part, love thy neighbor. But the rabbi understood that the second part of that sentence is just as important, that if you can't love yourself, you can't love anybody else either. If you don't respect yourself, you can't respect others either. Self-hatred or a lack of self-respect is destructive in every possible way. The rabbi understood that even as a child of 8, at night he would write a list. He would put a list of all his good qualities. I am not what the Nazis say I am. A list of my good qualities. And he knew that he was unique in these qualities in his head and his heart. And that gave him important spiritual nourishment that allowed him to survive truly terrible times. Now, it's easy for us also to sort of imbibe and internalize these very negative stereotypes and social norms and expectations. And we end up castigating ourselves, sometimes even despising ourselves for being overweight, for being not a success, right? I could have been a contender for being gay, for being unattractive or old or whatever it may be. Our bar for ourselves is higher than we can possibly measure up, and we lash out at ourselves for not measuring up to these impossible standards. Instead of looking at ourselves in a detached and kind way and saying, you know, you did a pretty good job. You did good. You did good. Give yourself a break. You give others a break. Give yourself a break. We castigate ourselves for not being perfect and not being like Barbie and Ken. But Hinduism would take this a step further. When we talk about compassion for ourselves, what do we mean by ourselves? That's the point. Again, in Sanskrit, for the word for self is Atman. Now, usually when we say Atman, we're talking about the divine reality within us. But depending on the context of the sentence, it actually just means self. So in the Taittiriya Upanishad, there's a discussion of the five selves, or the five Atmans, which I'm like, what? But they have a discussion about the way we all self-identify. So when we first begin our process of like identification, the first thing we come up with is the body self. This, and they call it the anamaya atman, or the food self. What we created through food, this is what our investigation kind of begins and ends with this. I am this. Okay? I'm the gross matter self. So when you say I'm fat, I'm talking about this gross matter self. But then if our investigation goes deeper, we lose someone we love. And we look at them and they've just died. The life force, or what they say in Sanskrit, the prana, has left the body. We look at this person who was full of vigor and fun and joy, and it's just dead matter. The person that we loved is gone. And we realize, no, I am not just this body, that the prana, the spirit within that enlivens me, that gives me my strength and energy, my prana, that's who I am. And we go along, okay, so I am the prana, I am this energy within, and the body is a sheath, a covering over that prana. So my sense of who myself is has changed. Oh, I'm the prana. But then we start thinking about that more. I go, wait, I have a mind. My mind is faster than anything in the universe. It's quicker than thought. What is nothing is quicker than thought. So I am my mind. Oh, that is who I really am, my mind self. So then we identify with the mind. And then the mind is who we think we are. And over that is the sheath of the prana. And over that is the sheath of the body. And our investigation continues and deeper and deeper and deeper until we make our investigation so deep that at last we encounter the divine self within us, the luminous, eternal, pure being. And then we realize that we've encountered eternal joy, eternal truth, eternal being, pure consciousness itself. When we reach this, which is the nature of eternal, unchanging bliss, we know beyond a shadow of a doubt that this is the real me. And then everything else is a sheath, a covering over that. But until we reach that point, until we encounter that divine self within us, we go through various identifications of what we think is the real me. And that's where we get back to the nature of compassion for ourselves and for others. It's our wrong identification with who or what is the real me and who or what is myself that has given us every grief we've ever had in our entire life. It gives us every grief and every base instinct we've ever had. When we begin to get in touch with that divine self within us, then we have true self-respect, true self-love, and genuine love and compassion for ourselves and for others. Our compassion will have nothing to do with helping others or pitying others. We will see the divine self within them as clearly as we see the divine self within ourselves. And we will have no desire except to love and to serve. Swami Vivekananda said to his American audience over a century ago, God has not fallen into a ditch for you or me to help him by building a hospital or something of that sort. He allows you to work. Do you think even an ant will die for want of your help? The world does not need you at all. The world goes on. You're like a drop in the ocean. A leaf does not move, the wind does not blow without him. Blessed are we that we are given the privilege of working for him, of helping him. You are here at his pleasure. He is all, and he is in all. We are allowed to worship him. Stand in that reverent attitude before the whole universe. And I think this is where our compassion is located. In a reverent attitude to the whole universe. If we can love and serve the many manifestations of God standing and sitting right before us, what a privilege for us. What a blessing. What a blessing. I hope and pray that every one of us can experience that, this attitude of love and service and reverence before the whole universe as a manifestation of divinity. Thank you.